Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight we're going to approach things in a slightly different way and look at questions around memorials, statues, and memorialisation and historical memory, and look at certainly the largest and one of the most significant statues to commemorate the Second World War. Which is the Motherland Cause, which is the great statue to the Battle of Stalingrad, and really to the Soviet war dead in general, at Mamayev Kurgan, which is on the hilltop just above Stalingrad, where some of the fiercest fighting of the entire siege took place. We're looking at Prisoners of History, which is the new book by Keith Lowe, and as you'll know, I've been a real fan of his work for some time. And the reason why I think it's important to look at memorialisation about historical memory and how historical memory is captured in sort of in concrete, as it is in this case, is because it's the way in which certain groups and normally states establish their conquest of the past, and the way in which the past is transported into the present in kind of material form. And so without further ado, let's talk about the Motherland Cause. And Keith Lowe writes, Mamayev Kurgan is not the site of a single monument, but of a complex of monuments, each more gigantic than the last. The first time I came there, I felt it was entering a realm of titans. At the foot of the hill stands a huge sculpture of a bare-chested man clutching a machine gun in one hand and a grenade in the other. He seems to rise out of the very rock, torso rippling, as tall as a three-story building. Beyond him, on either side of the steps that lead to the summit, are relief sculptures of giant soldiers springing out of the ruined walls as if in the midst of battle. Farther up the hill is a gigantic figure of a grieving mother, more than twice the size of my house. She's hunched over the body of her dead son, sobbing into a large pool of water called the Lake of Tears. The dozens of statues arranged in this park are all giants. Not one of them is under 6 metres or 20 feet tall, and some of them depict heroes 3 or 4 times that size. And yet they are dwarfed by the single statue that rises above them all, on the summit of the hill. Here, overlooking the Volga, stands the colossal representation of Mother Russia, beckoning to her children to come and fight for her. Her mouth is open in battle cry, her hair and dress fluttering in the wind. And in her right hand she holds a vast sword, pointing up into the sky. From her feet to the tip of her sword, she stands at nearly 85 metres, or 280 feet tall. She is nearly twice as tall and 40 times as heavy as the Statue of Liberty in New York City. When she was first unveiled in 1967, she was the largest statue in the world. So, the Motherland Calls was built long after Stalin himself was dead and gone. I mean, partly the huge nature of the project was one factor in why it took so long. But also the fact that the Soviet Union needed to continue to memorialise the loss and the trauma of the war, and to continue, particularly during the Cold War, to give reason and purpose to the war as the great patriotic struggle. By the late 1960s, when the statue was unveiled, the Soviet Union was encountering a prolonged economic downturn, which morphed into the kind of the sluggishness of the 1970s. And part of the political purpose of remembering the sacrifices of the war and the destruction of fascism and the great patriotic nature of the war, which is referred to as the Great Patriotic War, was to remind the Soviet population of its kind of historic purpose, when that by 1967 must have seemed kind of quite distant compared to the seemingly kind of endless crises of Soviet communism. Here, of course, you have a regime that was seriously challenged by its nearest neighbour, Maoist China. You have a regime that is failing in the Cold War. You have a regime whose any claim by the following year, by 1968, any claim of being emancipatory or part of the future of humanity is, proved a nonsense by the Soviet overthrow of a democratic regime in Czechoslovakia. You have a regime that had already shown its ability to be vastly more brutal in 1956 in Hungary, that had crushed as equivalent uprisings in the early 1950s in Poland and in East Germany. So, using memorialisation to focus on this one key aspect of struggle against an external enemy, particularly an external enemy as monstrous as Nazi Germany, is hugely hugely valuable to state propagandists. Of course, this is part of Britain's endless experience with our kind of national obsession with wartime nostalgia, that Britain's relative economic and social decline since the Second World War can be easily shadowed and easily sort of blotted out by kind of glorious tales of wartime derring do, which of course don't have to stand up to close scrutiny particularly, or have to stand in comparison to the massive sacrifices made by the Soviet Union. Anyway, to continue, Keith Lowe writes, "This memorial, entitled The Motherland Calls, is one of Russia's most iconic statues. It was the creation of Soviet sculptor Yevgeny Vuketich, who spent years designing and building it. It contains around 2,500 metric tons of metal and 5,500 tons of concrete. The sword alone weighs 14 tons. So huge was the statue that Vuketich was obliged to collaborate with the structural engineer, Nikolai Nikitin, to ensure that it did not collapse under its own weight. Holes had to be drilled in the sword to reduce the threat of wind catching it and causing the whole structure to sway. Were this monument in Italy or France, it would appear absurdly grandiose, but here on the banks of the Volga, in the city that was once called Stalingrad, it feels quietly appropriate. The battle that took place here in 1942 dwarfs anything that happened in the West. It began with the greatest German bombardment of the war and progressed with attacks and counterattacks by more than a dozen entire armies. Within the city itself, soldiers fought from street to street and even from room to room in a landscape of shattered houses. Over the course of 5 months, around 2 million men lost their lives, their health, or their liberty. The combined casualties of this one battle were greater than the casualties that Britain and America together suffered during the whole of the war. As one stands on the summit of Mamayev Kurgan, in the shadow of the gigantic statue of the motherland, one can feel the weight of all this history. And I suppose that is the point of memorials and statues and public markers of shared histories, is to imbue them with that certain kind of totemic power, which one gains the sense that history almost runs through the object. The cenotaph in the Mall, for example, or the Lincoln Memorial, or the Washington Monument, or any of these, again, these iconic or totemic objects designed to really channel the way in which the public conceives of the past. And also they are tools for kind of dominating public space that can be used in a variety of different ways. Well, a monument, something like the Motherland Calls, gives the public space an unmistakable and overwhelming and defined meaning. Keith Lowe writes, "It's oppressive, even for a foreigner, but for many Russians this place is sacred. The word Kurgan in Russian means tumulus or burial mound. The hill is an ancient site dedicated to a 14th century warlord, but in the wake of the greatest battle of the greatest war in history, it carries a new symbolism. This place was one of the major battlegrounds of 1942, and an unknown number of soldiers and civilians are buried here. Even today, when walking on the hill, it's possible to find fragments of metal and bone buried in the soil. The Motherland statue stands both figuratively and literally upon a mountain of corpses." And one could argue that so does 20th century Russia. The scale of the war in Russia, writes Keith Lowe, is one reason why the monuments at Mamayev Kurgan are so huge. But it's not the only reason. In fact, it's not even the main reason. The statues of muscular heroes and weeping mothers might be huge, but it is the giantess on the summit of the hill that dominates them all. It's important to remember that this is a representation not of the war but of the motherland. It is a message. Its message is simple. No matter how great the battle, no matter how great the enemy, the motherland is still greater. Her colossal size is supposed to be a comfort to the struggling soldiers and weeping mothers, a reminder that for all their sacrifice, they are at least a part of something powerful and magnificent. This is the true meaning of Mamayev Kurgan. The war years for the Soviet Union saw a kind of a radical reversal in all sorts of aspects of public discourses about the Soviet state. Stalin was quite conscious in his use of really quite antiquated language to motivate the population. This was a holy war, in a way. This was the great patriotic war for the motherland. These are terms that had never really been used about the Soviet Union prior to 1941. And the depictions of figures such as Alexander Nevsky, who defeated the Teutonic Knights of Friedrich Barbarossa the first time round, was resurrected, and instead of the revolution being the motivating factor in encouraging people to defend the nation.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The nation itself was the motherland, and that was the thing that was and should be motivating Soviet citizens. And of course, these motivations to nation and tribe and identity and nationality run far deeper than imposed and fairly superficially imposed revolutionary concepts and ideological precepts. And the Motherland Calls was built, of course, in 1967, years after the end of the war, 22 years after the end of the war, 22 years which would, for most Soviet citizens, have been exceedingly bleak, and even as material conditions improved, still, the shadow of the war and of the mass killings by Stalin before it were a kind of almost unending trauma in Russian society. Keith Lowe writes, "In the aftermath of the Second World War, the people of the Soviet Union had little to console them. Not only were they traumatized by loss, but they also faced an uncertain future. Russians did not benefit economically from the war as the Americans did. The violence had left their economy in ruins. Nor did Russians win any new freedoms, despite the widespread hopes of a political thaw after 1945. Stalinist repression soon started up all over again. Life in Russia after the war was grim. The only consolation offered to Russia and to other Soviet people was that their country had proven itself at last to be a truly great nation. In 1945, the USSR possessed the largest army the world had ever seen. It dominated not only the vast Eurasian landmass, but also the Baltic and the Black Sea. The Second World War had not only restored the country's borders, but extended them both to the east and the west. And Soviet influence now stretched deep into the heart of Europe. Before the war, the Soviet Union had been a second-rate power, weakened by internal upheaval. After the war, it was a superpower." And, of course, the Soviet Union had, in the eyes of its citizens, scored an immense moral victory over the evils of Nazism. One has to, of course, ignore the evils of Stalinism during the war and the many, many horrific abuses and murders of civilians and prisoners during the war for that one to make any sense. But when Soviet soldiers liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau, there was a widespread belief amongst them that when they saw the horrors of what the Nazis had done, that whatever their side had perpetrated, it was as nothing compared to the evils of Nazism, and that the war itself had been a great moral crusade and was had been the right conflict to fight. And of course, you know, when the British discovered Bergen-Belsen, when the Americans discovered Dachau, a very similar experience was had amongst British and American soldiers of these. This was an evil regime, and we were right to fight it to the end. The Motherland statue on Mamiev Kurgan was designed to be proof of all of this, the of the newfound Soviet military prowess and conquest. It was built in the 1960s when the USSR was at the height of its strength. It stood as a warning to anyone who dared attack the Soviet Union, but also as a symbol of reassurance to the Soviet people. The giant, it was declared, would always protect them. For the Russian citizens who first stood on the summit of this hill, with the Motherland statue at their backs, the vistas looked endless. Everything to the west of them for 1,000 miles was Soviet territory. To the east they could travel through 9 time zones without once leaving their country. Even the heavens seemed to belong to them. The first man in space, a Russian, and the first woman too. It's impossible to look up at the Motherland statue without gazing beyond to the endless skies over her. Since those days, Russia has never stopped building war memorials. Many of them are on a similar scale to those at Volgograd, or Stalingrad as it was. In 1974, for example, the statue, 42 metres tall, high, of a Soviet soldier was erected in Murmansk in memory of the men who died during the defence of the Arctic Russia during July 1941. In the early 1980s, when Ukraine was still part of the Soviet Union, a second Motherland statue was erected at Kiev. Like the statue on Mamiev Kurgan, it was designed by Vukotic, including its plinth. It stands over 100 metres or 320 feet tall. And in 1985, in celebration of the 40th anniversary of the end of the war, a 79 metre high victory monument around 260 feet tall was erected in Riga, the capital of Soviet Latvia. All of these statues and monuments were meant to be symbols of power and confidence. But a generation after the Motherland statue in Volgograd was inaugurated, Soviet power began to waver. In the 1980s, Eastern Bloc countries like Poland and East Germany began to pull away from Soviet influence, culminating in the collapse of communism in those countries in 1989. Then pieces of the Soviet Union itself began to break off, first Lithuania in March 1990, followed by, in quick succession, by 13 other states in the Baltic, Eastern Europe, the Caucasus and Central Asia. The giant was crumbling. The dissolution of the USSR was finally announced on the 26th of December 1991. So sometimes statues of conflicts past, of achievements past, of glories past, are ways of compensating for the crises of the present, or the shortcomings of the present. And it is noticeable across the faltering democracies of Great Britain and the United States of America in the past couple of years that statues have become focal points of kind of reactionary right-wing rhetoric and culture war conflict as... The present becomes ever more uncertain and ever more shaky. Looking to the past and looking to kind of cherry-picked aspects of the past to memorialise is for certain demographics and who kind of hove to nationalist ideas and a sense of stability and continuity and patriotism. This is hugely, hugely important, and then this is how they become flashpoints of conflict, as the past is inevitably. If you look at the Colston statue here in Bristol in the UK, the past is always contested. The sense of despair, writes Keith Lowe, the sense of despair felt by many Russians, this is in 1991, in the period was palpable. Madeleine Albright, America's Secretary of State at the end of the 1990s, tells the story of meeting a Russian man who complained that we used to be a superpower, but now we're Bangladesh with missiles. For decades, national greatness had been the only consolation for all the loss that men like him had suffered throughout the century. Now this, too, had been taken away. In such an atmosphere, Russia's gargantuan war memorials began to look less like symbols of power and more like Ozymandias in the famous poem by Shelley, relics of past glories destined to be swallowed slowly but surely by the sands of time. But this did not stop the Russian authorities from building them. On the contrary, Russia has never stopped celebrating the glories of the Second World War. In 1995, for example, a brand new museum of the Great Patriotic War was opened in Moscow. In front of it stands a monument that is even taller than the statue at Mamiev Kurgan. In fact, standing at 141.8 metres or 465 feet is the tallest Second World War memorial anywhere in the world. Other monuments followed in April 2007 at Belgrad, Kursk and Oryol were declared cities of military glory because of the role they had played during the war, and brand new obelisks were erected in each location. The following October, five more cities were given the title and five more obelisks erected. Within just 5 years, more than 40 cities across Russia are honoured in the same way, with a brand new monument springing from Vyborg to Vladivostok. Why do Russians continue to commemorate the war in this manner? More than 75 years have passed since the final days of the conflict. Is it not time to lay it to rest? Well, this is an interesting, complex and vexed question. And the idea, firstly, that this is Russians doing this and not the state doing it, is challengeable. What tends to happen with the creation of official public memorialisation of sculptures is that governments build them. They may well have widespread public popularity. They may not. It's difficult to gauge. But often these things are built not so much to commemorate wars, but to harness and to direct nationalist sentiment or a sense of wanting to belong to or be connected to the past. And the reason for harnessing that is almost always duplicitous. It's always a way of detracting from current problems or trying to bolster support for a particular political party or leader based on the extent to which they appear to be patriotic or they appear to be able to reward ordinary citizens with a sense of duty and pride and civic self-belief and confidence. Anyway, we'll look more at Keith Lowe's excellent book, Prisoners of History. This book was sent to me, by the way, from an independent bookshop called Storytellers Inc. in St. Anne's-on-Sea. I've kind of adopted Storytellers Inc. as my source of books. I urge everybody who's listening to do something similar. If you want to get yourself a really good book, anything I recommend, or anything else, if you pay £1 or £2 more and order it directly from a local bookshop, you know that couple of pounds won't cost you anything really. It's not really going to change your life or, you know, turn your world upside down, is it? But it will be a lifeline to an independent retailer. And once those guys are gone, they're not coming back. You know, they're part of an ecosystem that we must support. So I've adopted Storytellers Inc. So if you're listening out there, find an independent bookshop. It can be anyone you like, because you know, they'll put things in the post to you, and adopt them for all your book needs. It'll only cost you a couple of pounds more in every purchase, perhaps not even that, and you'll be doing them a wonderful help, because we need those guys. Anyway, that's my little speech. Come over and check us out at explaininghistory.org. There'll be new content going up there pretty soon. I'm going to be putting some new stuff on YouTube, and we'll be working on some of the major projects of Explaining History that should be coming out next year, about which more you'll hear soon. Take good care, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.